From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
You know, to just be grossly generalistic, you could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
That was the voice of then Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton last September, describing Trump voters.
Right? The racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it.
The widely unexpected win by Trump in both the primary and general election had most of the media and political class pointing to racist white voters as the core of his constituency. This was CNN commentator Van Jones discussing the election returns on November 8th.
This was a white lash against a changing country. It was a white lash against a black president in part.
In American popular culture, it's become difficult to distinguish between the racist, misogynist xenophobes described by Hillary Clinton and members of the white working class in general.
And the poor kids and the middle class kids, they're all copying the rich kids. They're all going the same goddamn screw America way. Hippies.
That was actor Peter Boyle's character Joe from the movie of the same name, which was released in July of 1970. At the height of the protests against the Vietnam War and the radicalization of the civil rights movement and other social turmoil.
See, now the police in this town ain't going to bust their ass over one junkie murder. See, a guy who kills one junkie might kill another junkie. So why bust him? He's doing such good work for the cops. See? That make you feel better?
In a 2005 interview with Alan Neuwirth, Boyle described his surprise at the popularity of the character he had created.
The picture was so such a low-budget movie and so inauspicious that I thought nobody would ever see it.
And what was your reaction to the...
Well, when the movie first opened, it opened at a little theater on Times Square called The Embassy in the middle of July 1970, and the hot summer night, they decided to keep the picture open 24 hours. They kept showing it all around the clock. And I went down there to see it with a friend of mine and snuck into the audience and heard the audience yelling back at the screen.
In favor of Joe?
Both.
That controversy drove huge success at the box office, which did not go unnoticed by television, which, within 6 months, produced this well-known character.
An American history lesson. You don't know nothing about Lady Liberty standing there in the harbor with her torch on high, screaming out to all the nations of the world, send me your poor, your deadbeats, your filthy. And all the nations sent them in here. They come swarming in like ants. Your Spanish PRs from the Caribbean there. Your Japs, your Chinamen, your Krauts and your Hebes, and your leading spies. Come in here, and they're all free to live in their own separate sections. Where they feel safe, and they bust your head if you go in there. That's what makes America great, buddy.
But who and what constitutes the white working class in the United States? In this first edition of a series with Professor Tony Montero, we're going to look at exactly that. We begin today with an election for district attorney in Philadelphia last year. Vanessa Baker is an activist and a journalist who worked on the Larry Krasner campaign for DA last year. We spoke with her via Skype from Philadelphia Friday. First of all, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you actually got out among the people, as they say, got to engage with people on the ground and maybe had your own perception of things, enhanced by that. Let's start with the campaign that you were working on and the political landscape with the candidates that were running for district attorney in Philadelphia, where the Fraternal Order of Police are very powerful and very reactionary. Ask Mumia Abu-Jamal, for example.
Sure. Right. So, it was a really interesting race because we had Rich Negrin, who was endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, who, you know, which was recently in the news, you know, calling black protesters animals and, you know, just, you know, has a really bad reputation. There is a Nazi, like a known Nazi that works for them that has Nazi tattoos. And so this is who endorsed the other candidate who actually won in the district or in the ward next to the one that I canvassed. And then we have Krasner, who's literally the most progressive DA that we've ever had in Philly, certainly, and possibly even the country. And so, you know, my job was to talk to folks in the white working class about Krasner, you know, this guy who's running against the death penalty, who's who wants to end civil asset forfeiture. You know, he's going to stop charging low level drug offenders for their crimes. And, you know, so my job was to sell my neighbors who are white working class folks on him.
Yeah, he's raising mass incarceration as a problem and something, an actual problem that he wants to remedy, which is not exactly the center of gravity of your average district attorney candidate anywhere in the country, let alone one who's going to be campaigning in a district that is populated by what people call the white working class, which Hillary Clinton called the deplorables.
Exactly. And this is, you know, and this is the thing, like, I mean, obviously, like ever since Bill Clinton, you know, and all of his triangulation, I mean, the white working class and just working class people in general, you know, have been written off by the Dems. The Democrats have, you know, as you know, like moved rightward. And, you know, the Democratic Party has pretty much said, like, well, where else do you have to go? You know, Thomas Frank mentioned that in his book, Listen Liberal. And, you know, and I think his analysis is really on point, you know. And, you know, what did Obama do? You know, I mean, he was trying to push the TPP through just like Bill Clinton pushed through NAFTA. And, you know, like, why on earth would, you know, would working class people want to vote for Hillary Clinton? And yet she calls them deplorables because they voted, you know, for the person who actually was speaking to their concerns. You know, I mean, I certainly don't approve of Trump at all, but, you know, I think the Democratic Party has a lot to answer for. I mean, she didn't even go to Michigan. She didn't even go to Wisconsin. You know, so how can they say that you know that these people didn't do enough, like that they you know didn't try to stand up for their own interests? The Dems weren't concerned about their interests.
Yeah, that's an interesting little piece of sleight of hand that goes on, too, by the way. The white working class, quote unquote, and I'm going to stop putting quotes around it, but every time I say it, please, folks, understand that I'm putting quotes around it because we haven't really defined it. But the white working class is, on the one hand, you know, considered they're irreparably racist and, you know, deplorable, as Hillary Clinton said, and, you know, reactionary, hardcore reactionary, like the movie Joe, like the hard hats whistling at hippie girls in 1970 in New York City and beating skulls at anti-war protests, like, you know, marching in, you know, Nazi, neo-Nazi and KKK parades. That's how they're presented on the one hand. On the other, you know, policy-wise, Clinton and, you know, the whole DLC contingent of the Democratic Party, and really the center of gravity of the politicians in the Democratic Party, even outside the DLC, their policies with respect to workers were definitely to the right of the sentiments of these white working class people who, in the main, were union workers for a very long time. So there was an interesting sleight of hand where they redefined them over social issues rather than economic ones as being left or right, which is, by the way, not how you define things on that spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you look at, I mean, you know, there's the whole Archie Bunker stereotype, but then also if you look at, like, if you watched Roseanne in the 90s, I mean, now her politics have changed a lot, and I won't even speak to, like, whatever, she's saying about Israel and stuff. But, like, if you look at, you know, Roseanne in the 90s, I mean, she was as left as they come, you know? I mean, this was still when, like, the reality of what Clinton was doing, like, was yet to set in, you know? And, you know, I mean, people, people in, like, you know, what people call like flyover states, like, you know, weren't so conservative, weren't so, you know,
so reactionary.
Yeah. So reactionary. Thank you. but you know, it's like they're being forced and they're being like, kind of like gerrymandered almost, like they're being forced into this weird, you know, constituency based on, they're
ideological, like, gerrymandering. That's an interesting
ideological
concept.
Gerrymandering. Yeah. Like, and it's, you know, it's not necessarily, that doesn't necessarily represent really what people's deepest concerns are. I think, you know, I mean, when I was talking to folks, you know, people are concerned with the same issues that anybody else is. They're concerned about jobs, and what these middle class people don't understand, who are looking down their noses at Trump voters, is that if you're an engineer, if you're a doctor, if you're a professor, your job is protected by visa laws from international competition. You know, so like if you are in a profession, you know, you enjoy a protected status that working class people don't.
Right.
And so, you know, working class people who like deliver pizzas, you know, I mean, stuff like that, unfortunately, like, you know, their jobs are not protected. And, you know, they do have real concerns about, you know, about the outlook, and they've been screwed over under Obama, under Clinton. You know, I mean,
Bush,
all the Dems are doing are saying, oh, get a better education. Well, with what, you know?
Right. And then if you have a better education, you can ask the millions of people that are living in mommy and daddy's basement with $100,000 worth of debt and no job. Gee, how'd that work for you?
Right.
I want to go to this piece that you wrote. There's a piece that you authored titled "A Recognition That We're All Getting Screwed, Winning the White Working Class for Criminal Justice Reform," which relates to your experience in this campaign. It's at nplusonemag.com. It's N, the letter, plus onemag.com. You know, you start out talking about Port Richmond, a working class neighborhood in Philadelphia, with the doorbells there, that you were knocking on doors, and, you know, what you encountered. So why don't you tell us a little bit what you thought, what your kind of framing of the community you were going into was like, what you expected to encounter, you know, with the people there trying to sell this guy who wants to end mass incarceration, was going up against the Fraternal Order of Police, et cetera, et cetera. And then what you encountered walking in with that framework and maybe what you learned.
Yeah, so it was so interesting because, you know, people were really curious. People wanted to have a conversation, and nobody had been having these conversations with them. Like, the left, you know, hasn't really come out to Port Richmond. And like, I live here and I've lived here. This is going to be my sixth year now. And, you know, people are really friendly. Like, you know, we have block parties and my neighbors, you know, are always sitting outside in lawn chairs, like pretty much every night that it's nice out, you know, just talking, and they know everybody's name, you know, like, they know everybody's kids. Like, it's a really close knit community. And, you know, if you say like, I'm your neighbor and I want to talk with you, like, people will have a conversation. And they're not, it's not like with middle class people who just kind of like need to prove, you know, that they're so smart and so confident and whatever, like, they really want to like actually listen too. And, you know, I was chatting with a lot of people that were asking questions, and you know, I didn't get that sense knocking on doors that, you know, people already had the information. You know, I think the middle class really prides itself on like having all the information and being well informed. And it can come off as almost smug. Like, when I've knocked on doors in more gentrified areas, people are like, yeah, I've heard, you know, I know the facts. Like, I've already made up my mind. And who are you? Like, you know, but here people, they want to talk. And, you know, I just think that, you know, the Dems have obviously done a poor job of even speaking to the issues that people are concerned with. But, you know, like, I think the left has a little bit to answer to as well, in terms of like getting out of our comfort zone, you know, and talking to the real and actual working class, and not just necessarily like that Soviet mural version of like some guy in a jumpsuit, you know, like hefting a shovel over his shoulder as the sun sets behind him. I think we gotta reach out more.
You know, not only that, what's interesting to me is the fact that people would even want to discuss a district attorney's race. It's not the presidential race, as you know.
Right.
Voter turnout in a presidential race is maybe 50-60% nationally, even where it's really heavily contested like last year. When you get to the off years, say here in New York, the other even years between the presidential elections, the governor's races, and the turnout there is perhaps half of what it is during a presidential one. And then the odd years where you've got like county executive and DA and all that, maybe a quarter to a third of voters show up. And you're talking about a primary for the DA, which is even a smaller group of people that are going to turn out. And so you're going out to actually discuss policy in a DA's office with people, not the hot topic usually.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The turnout has pretty much been stable. Like in the last DA race in 2009, 795. And then this time there were 794. So it was only a difference of one voter.
Wow.
So it was really stable, stable number. But, you know, I wouldn't say it was like exceptionally like high turnout, but, you know, people are real, they are concerned about crime and they do like pretty consistently get out there. And, you know, they do care. The same people, you know, election after election do care and are concerned about crime. It's, you know, we're right next to, Kensington, which is, the epicenter of the opioid epidemic in Philly. And really on the East Coast, like this, like Kensington is the most notorious drug corner on the East Coast. You know, there were, I don't know. I want to say like 700 some deaths from heroin last year, but I don't want to say exactly
almost two a day. In other words, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's bad, you know, and they just, like recently they just, pretty much evicted the homeless people from their camp. They were camping out in this abandoned train track, in tents, and they just whacked it down. So like all those people that were sleeping in tents out there now are like wandering the neighborhoods and, you know, smashing people's car windows and stuff, like even more than they were before. So, I mean, this is only five blocks away from Port Richmond where I live. And part of the ward that I canvassed was in Kensington. So, I mean, like, you know, everybody on my block has had their car windows smashed, at least once.
Ouch, geez.
You know, I've had mine smashed twice. Like, you know, I mean, you see people pushing carts up and down the street full of scrap metal, you know, to redeem for, you know, pennies a pound. I mean, it's pretty bad out here, you know, and so people are concerned about crime.
Yeah. And, all right. So you have 800 people and this is what, this is a, what do they call them? Wards or election districts or what that you were working? What's the term of
it's ward? Philly has wards, so I was in the 25th ward.
Okay. I live in a community, everything's at large in Ostending, New York, where I live. There's a population of 25,000. I would say between a third and a half are enrolled as voters. In a mayoral election, perhaps 2,000 to 3,000 people vote.
Wow. So,
and this is in the suburbs. It's semi-middle class. You know, Austin was a prison town, but now it's kind of like a yuppie, condo haven and or whatever. So, you know, those numbers are higher than they are in, you know, poor neighborhoods in New York City or whatever. And it's still pretty abysmal. I mean, we're talking about maybe 10% of the population turns out to elect the mayor. all right. Well, so the turnout is very thin, of course, and that's the salient point. But, you know, you motivated. Well, let me ask you a question. The last election for district attorney in this particular district, how did they go then? Who were the two candidates? How were they differentiated, you know, on policy, if they were? And how did the district vote?
Okay. So, last time Seth Williams won in Philly, But he actually did not win in this ward. A guy named Dan McCaffrey won. This was in 2009. So Seth Williams is black. Uh-huh. Dan McCaffrey is white. Mm-hmm. I don't want to reduce it to that, but you know, they were both, you know, pretty far leaning in terms of their platforms. So, you know, I feel like that's probably the salient factor.
Yeah, they were similar in platform, and so the basically the distinguishing one is these two guys are the same. This is the white guy. This is the black guy. That's kind of what the election was like. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay. So and who won this district? The white guy or the black guy?
The white guy.
Okay. So now you have one based on policy where you've gone out and done some rather, you know, intensive discussion of policy with voters, mm-hmm. and these people that would be seen as deplorables by Hillary Clinton and others vote for the progressive, the guy who wants to end mass incarceration, etc. I'm assuming that, yeah, you know, out of those 790 some odd voters, that you know, some of them knew that and voted for him either despite that or because of that. And
it was really amazing because there were a lot of people that I talked to that initially were very like tough on crime, you know, lock them up, throw away the key, you know, kind of what you would expect. Like, you know, I mean, when you see NRA stickers on the door and stuff like that, you know, I mean, there are a lot of police that live in my neighborhood. And in fact, the Police Athletic League is like right in the center of my district, and my district won like more than most of the other, like with a stronger margin than most of the other districts in the ward. Divisions. Yeah. But anyway, so yeah, like this is kind of an area where people are very pro police, and you know, really you know, they would say Blue Lives Matter here.
Right.
And when they came to the doors, you know, most of the people were saying something like that. Most of the white people that I talked with, and most of the people here are white. And, but, you know, I tried a couple different tactics. You know, and one thing is most people here have somebody in their family who's been touched by the opioid epidemic. Like, yeah, you know, I mean, it's five blocks away, you know, working, you know, employment is not very good here. You know, most people here have just like a high school diploma. So, you know, I mean, heroin use rises in areas where unemployment is high. And this is one of those places. And so, you know, most families have been touched by this. So, you know, when I talked about how, you know, Krasner wants to give people opportunities to get clean. And, you know, a lot of people assume that there are all these resources available, and there just aren't. You know, a statistic that I found from Prevention Point Philadelphia, which is a harm reduction clinic here, said that only one in four heroin addicts is able to access treatment. Wow. You know, that wants the treatment. Right. So that means that we're not really giving people a chance. And Krasner wants to stop charging these, you know, low-level drug offenders, and instead, you know, make that $42,000 a year that it costs to incarcerate someone, make that those funds available for treatment. You know, that would pay for two stints in rehab. So that's, you know, two chances. And a lot of people, you know, really got that, and they thought, you know, yeah, like, you know, it's we ought to be giving people chances, especially when you consider that, you know, the rate of recidivism is so high. You know, jail doesn't really get people clean. It doesn't really give them the tools to get clean. It just, you know, they meet other people who are in the same boat and just want to get high when they get out, you know?
Right. Yeah. And then they can share each other's connections and whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So, absolutely.
So, this was a significant concern among the people that you were speaking with. You know, I'm looking through the article. Again, we're talking about the piece that you wrote at N+1, a recognition that we're all getting screwed, winning the white working class for criminal justice reform. And this, you know, describes your experience going out and working for Larry Krasner, who's a progressive that ran for and ultimately won the election in Philadelphia for DA. And your experience with, you know, walking among the folks that are And within that group that, again, Hillary Clinton would call the deplorables. And these concerns are concerns that have been expressed, you know, in other communities for a very long period of time, given the economic change that has taken place in the United States and the blossoming of the opioid epidemic. These are now concerns shared across just about every community.
Yep. And I think it's, you know, it's also an issue of framing, you know. The left isn't really talking about crime. You know, the left talks about, you know, police brutality, which is a huge issue, and one that, you know, Krasner's platform focuses on, you know, but the left doesn't necessarily talk about how, you know, we can deal with people who are scared for their personal safety. You know, I met a young woman who had been attacked by a homeless drug user. The guy hit her with a rock. I mean, she showed me, you know, where she still had stitches on her head and, you know, bruises on her leg and stuff. You know, this girl was like, you know, I would say in her early 20s and, you know, was attacked on like a main street. So, you know, I mean, and this girl, like when I knocked on her house, I thought that it was an abandoned house and I thought that it was like kind of a outdated, address, but yeah, I mean, you know, she answered and she had this story to tell. And I just think that, like, you know, we need to get out there and like see the conditions that people are living in and like understand that, you know, people do have really valid concerns about safety. And then, you know, adapt our messaging to that and like show how justice makes us safer, which is, you know, Krasner's slogan, you know, because it, you know, it does make us safer if, you know, heroin addicts are being given access to treatment. You know, like heroin addicts aren't necessarily bad people. There's somebody's, you know, cousin. And, you know, I mean, I have 20 years clean, but, you know, I mean, I was a heroin addict when I was in high school. Mm. And, you know, I mean, these are people that are just in utter despair or, you know, had medical conditions. And, you know, I think that the left needs to talk about this aspect more and just change our messaging a little bit more and it'll be more effective instead of, you know, I mean, I wouldn't go to these doors and start talking about, you know, how Krasner defended occupiers and Black Lives Matter, you know, well, you know, I was part of Occupy and, you know, this is all really important stuff, but it's just, you have to know who you're talking with and what their concerns are, you know?
Yep. And the history, for example, we're talking about the same city that had Frank Rizzo as mayor. I remember him from way back when. If you want to talk about the caricature of working people like Archie Bunker or Joe, you know, Peter Boyle's Joe, Frank Rizzo is perfect.
Politicians have done a really good job of pitting the working class against itself, you know, and unfortunately the Dems have come on the wrong side of, you know, of the white working class. And so, I mean, a lot of people do turn to like these xenophobic, you know, explanations for what's going on because nobody's talking to them. You know, I mean, and I'm not going to say that's the only factor in white supremacy, but obviously not. But I think that, you know, I think we could do a better job of reaching people and appealing to like their real concerns. You know, there is, I'm not going to lie, like there is a lot of racism in my neighborhood and it's not the bougie, like nicey dog whistle racism that you'll get up in the suburbs, like in Chestnut Hill and places like that. It's pretty ugly, but
yeah,
they don't even have the power to do anything with it.
We're going to probe this stuff some more with Professor Tony Montero over the next couple of weeks. And I'd also, at that point, like to look at some of the data, because you did accumulate some data while you were walking the district, about the district.
Yeah.
And I'd like to do that because, as we've discussed with Professor Montero, we're going to take a look at that data, which was accumulated in this particular neighborhood, a white working class neighborhood, in 2016, and take a look at a study that was done by W.E.B. Du Bois with data that was accumulated in 1896 that formulated the basis of his very important study called the Philadelphia Negro. And so we're going to speak with you again, and I thank you very, very much, Vanessa, for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.